So the goal of this shiur and the next few shiurim are going to be a chazara of what we did over this past winter in Smichas Chaver. It's a tremendous accomplishment. We learned an entire section of Shulchan Aruch, Hilchas Bikur Cholim, through Hilchas Avelos, and while we didn't do everything, we did a large part of it. We missed primarily the Tumah part of it, Tumas Kohanim, etc. But we should be proud of what we did, and the hope is just to do an overview of the of what we did, mainly the Halacha L'maaseh parts of it. I may add a thing or two here. I'm not going to do everything. I'm not going to go into much of the lumdas we discussed, even some of the background. And I'll send out the notes as well, so you have that in your files to review. So let's begin. If you recall, way back when, right after Sukkot, we began discussing that there is some sort of superstition, if you want to call it that, about learning Hilchos Avelos. We shouldn't be learning Hilchos Avelos. We shouldn't be doing that. We quoted Chassam Sofer, who said that he was very scared to talk about Hilchos Avelos. But then we said, look, the Chassam Sofer has many tshuvas about it, so clearly it's not a problem. Even moreover, we quoted Shlomo Zalman, who said he would give a weekly shiur in Hilchos Avelos. And we also quoted Rav Avadi Yosef, who said it's his skula to discuss Hilchos Avelos. And we also mentioned, as a rabbi, I can tell you that the one time you get shilas where you don't have an answer, don't have time to look up the answer, is Hilchos Avelos. Those the answers out, you have to know them right away. Okay, so let's be with that introduction. Let us begin. We began learning the laws of Bikur Cholim. What is the idea of Bikur Cholim? Is it Daraisa? Is it Darabanan? We had a discussion then. What is it? Now we either it's a Daraisa or it's part of V'yahavta L'Recha Kamocha from the Rambam. Be it as it may, it's clearly an obligation. In fact, we even quoted the Ramban, who said maybe it's part of Hashavas Aveda, the same way if I have to return your lost item, to restore you to your health. That being said, what exactly is the obligation? So we said there could be two obligations, two parts to it. We quoted Gemara to Rabbi Akiva that he showed up to, it was Gemara Nedarim, he showed up to one of his Talmidim who was ill, and he realized no one had visited him. And since no one had visited him, he was lacking the basic need and care, so he attended to his needs. And he said anyone who doesn't visit someone who's sick is considered like a spilling their blood, because if the person is neglected, so then they can die. We even pointed out then just practically, to visit someone in the hospital when they won't be neglected, it's not just, or the assumption is they're not being neglected. That's not really true. When someone has visitors in the hospital, oftentimes it causes the hospital staff to be more careful and pay more attention to them, just the reality of how things are. And therefore, we see the goal of of Bikur Cholim is one, to tend to the needs of someone who's sick, but also we mentioned it's to daven for them. We said that person should, the Shechina is at the head of someone who's sick, but you're not supposed to sit at their head. When someone's sick, and you're supposed to daven for them. The Gemara points out, don't visit someone in the morning, don't visit someone in the late afternoon. Why not the morning? Because the person who wakes up, they're peppy, they're all excited, they're happy, they look good, they look healthy. At the end of the day, they look like it's over. Come in the middle of the day, we get a balanced view of what they're looking like, and then you walk away and you daven for them. Whereas you go at the end of the day, you won't want to daven, you'll say it's all over, except they'll come up soon. And the Aruch HaShulchan pointed out, this is not a halacha, this is just advice, because we want you to walk away with the appropriate mindset, so that you begin to daven for them. In fact, the Ramah codifies this in Shulchan Aruch that someone who visits someone and does not daven for them does not fulfill their obligation of Bikur Cholim. So very important is to daven for them. Okay, so that was that. We also pointed out, and we don't have to go through the details, that you just be smart. So I think the operative principle is be smart. If someone has something that's very embarrassing, don't show up. Don't show up unannounced. Knock before you enter. Again, these are things that you don't need Shulchan Aruch to tell you. Your mother can tell you. Excellent. Can you do perform Bikur Cholim by the phone? So we pointed out, or from Ramosha, and I quoted Rav Huttner, I think later on when it came to Avelos, that ideally one should not, because when you're present, you can, A, you can cheer someone up more, you can see what you can really tend to their needs. It's hard to tend to someone's needs when you're just calling in. But of course, there is some sort of measure of Bikur Cholim that could be performed by the phone. You can talk to them, you can make them feel a little better, you can help alleviate some of the loneliness, which is very important, as well as you can walk away and daven for them. Why is there no bracha for Bikur Cholim? A question we have to always ask for every mitzvah. We just discussed this at length for Bir Chametz or Bedikas Chametz, really. So we gave a number of answers. It was really cursory. They are, one is the Ars Zeruah said you only make a bracha on something that has a defined time, whereas Bikur Cholim really is always. It can always be. The Rashba, a famous answer found in Tshuva Yudches, says we don't make brachas on mitzvahs that are dependent on someone else, because let's say case there, I believe he's dealing with is you go to someone who is an ani and you offer them money and they say no. Well, you say, but you have to take it. I made a bracha. It's a bracha levatala. So, in order to avoid that, we don't make brachas on things that are dependent on someone else. The Shub Ben Yamin Zev said that we only make brachas on mitzvahs that set us apart from the world, whereas everyone does Bikur Cholim, Jews and non-Jews alike. And lastly, we mentioned an idea that when you make a bracha on mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro, it creates an almost transactional nature to it. Like, you're my mitzvah. We don't want someone to feel like they're just a mitzvah. We want them to feel like we're really caring for them, which is what we are. It's important to daven for someone who's sick. Really, we said you can, if you don't know someone's name, just say their name. You don't have to know their mother's name. We mentioned you can even daven for someone who's non-Jewish. We quoted a tshuva from Chacham Avadia about that as well. We also quoted the next tshuva about saying kaddish for someone who's not Jewish. We said, however, on Shabbos, we're not supposed to daven for someone who's sick. So we insert what we say the Gemara. We say Shabbos he lizogul lefuah karav lavo. Shabbos prohibits us from crying out, but since the person needs a lefuah karav lavo, so now basically it's like this Shabbos bread almost. And the Mishnah said that's why every time we make a Mishnah Berach on Shabbos, that's what we added in. Again, we put the mother's name. I think Svarna put the father's name in. Be it as it may, that's the format for doing it, but you can do it anyway. The Shulchan Aruch talks about what language to do it in, but I tell you, do it in whatever language that you feel most comfortable. We're supposed to, it's important to have a relationship with God, which only comes when you can actually speak to Him in a way that you understand. The Gemara talks about as well, we actually did this just today in Maseches Tainis, going to a tzaddik, someone who's a holy person, to daven for them. We also talk about adding a name on, and we noted then as well that there are a lot of different ways you can add a name on. Some have a whole elaborate ceremony. Some just say get an aliyah, or Mordechai Willig told me to just give someone an aliyah. We also noted that it's important to add a name on. Oftentimes, when you hear someone gets a name added on, it has a connotation like, oh, we're at the very end. Like, this is like, this is the Hail Mary. It's probably the wrong expression to use in this case. But that's not the case. It's actually, the whole idea is you add a new name on, and a person now, you can say, celestially, they have a different mazel, they have a different, they have a different, the constellations are different, they have a different mazel now, or perhaps it causes a person, Rambam Hilchos Tshuva says, you have a new name, you look yourself as a new person, you start acting differently, it causes you, and motivates you to do tshuva. Whatever it is, the point is you have to have the time to do that. And therefore, Rav Willig said to me, as well as I spoke to someone else about this, that to be sure, I don't remember, recall who, when you add a name on, add it at a point where, again, it's serious, but not like, okay, there's no hope left. There has to be hope where there's no real point in adding a name on. We also pointed out then that if you add a name on, the person lives beyond 30 days. We say beyond 30 days, and I forgot this up. It's not in the notes. It's just from my conversation with Willig. But I think, if the person outlives the illness, I forgot what the duration was. I think it was more than 30 days, so they keep that name, and they'll live with that name forevermore. I'll get back to that, exactly what the minhag of that is. The Gemara in Ksubas discusses Rebbe. Rebbe was suffering tremendously, and basically his maidservant davened that he should effectively die. And she was not, and her prayer wasn't answered, and then she threw a jug off the roof that caused everyone to stop davening, and she died. So Moshe sees from there that if you see someone is basically not improving, you can pray for them to die. We discussed this at length then, and we're not going to get into it now, but we said the approach that we should take is not we should daven for someone to die, but that we know with full understanding that God knows what is best, and therefore we daven that Hashem should do what is best for the person, and sometimes that can mean the person suffering ends, and sometimes it means they get better. It's really up to Hashem. This is a place where we say, V'yadcha kibruchi, and we place ourself in your hands, God, and God does what it's supposed to be. Lastly, the Shulchan Aruch Simon Shin Lama Zion said that if someone is very ill, we don't want to inform them that someone else passed away because that can exacerbate their illness, and therefore we don't do that. We talked about not crying in front of them. We even talked about, in terms of Hilchos Avelos, the heter you have to shave perhaps before you go visit someone who may realize from the lack of shaving that someone else had passed away. Okay, there is the Mara talks about the importance of saying vidoy. So basically, before someone dies, say vidoy, and you can atone for all their sins. We suggest to someone who can say vidoy, we say to them, look, someone's sick. Many people say vidoy, and they get better. It's a precautionary thing. It doesn't hurt to daven. It never hurts to daven. We say, some people say vidoy every day. This Sfar says vidoy every day. We don't want to scare you, but we also want you to know, like, this is something that's done, and therefore we say vidoy. And there's a shorter vidoy. There's a longer vidoy. There's the vidoy of Yom Kippur. We say Elokai Neshama, Nishmas Kol Chai. Lots of different things you can find in the vidoy in the bencher, except in the siddur. And that's, again, that's just something that's done. Can you say vidoy on behalf of someone else? So yeah, technically you could. We have to minute clients on vidoy. Does it really work? Does it help? I don't know. That's what's done. Okay. But certainly to whisper tefillos for them, that we assume they can hear it. And sometimes we say that the shamas around there. Okay, so that's what we do. Also, it's important to recognize that as a person gets sick, that's, in a way, there's a chesed there that a person can arrange their matters on earth, and it's important for a person to write a will, especially a halachic will, and do whatever they can to avoid any sort of contention among their children and descendants, and therefore it's important to do that, important to give tzedakah, etc. Okay. And it goes without saying that if you are dealing with someone who's towards the end of their life, be sensitive. Once a person is kind of in death throes, which is very hard to define, they're called a ghosts. A ghost is someone who knows basically it's over. And again, where how do you define it's very hard? And part of the issue in terms of a Kohen is a Kohen is not allowed to be in the same room as a ghost. So the reason being that, you know, it's imminent. Touching ghosts is prohibited because that can lead to, that can hasten the death. So again, a ghost is considered alive for all kinds of purposes, which means that if you kill a ghost, you've killed someone. When someone's a ghost, we don't bring the coffin in the house. We don't, right? You know, we don't eulogize them. Sorry, Tuesday with Maury. If you get my reference, great. We don't dig a kever. We don't do any of that. You know, I think as we can say that the two people who are always used to doing things last minute are the grave diggers and the moel. You just don't have much time in advance. Okay. Shulchan Aruch says that when someone's neshama is about to leave their body, you should have people present in the room with them so they don't leave. They don't leave alone. That's something that we don't have to leave alone. And people around there should be themselves using it as a time to do tshuva, to repent, and to spend time with the ghosts rather than speaking and conversing and, you know, chit chat. That's not really so appropriate. So in a way, it's a very holy moment, and not a moment. And especially, it's a moment when you realize just your own mortality, and to engage in chit chat, talking about, you know, ridiculousness, or especially, which can happen, unfortunately, fighting. You have siblings that show up, haven't seen each other in years, talked in years, and they're fighting at the last moment. Hello, what else do you need to remind yourself that, you know, your time in this world is very short? Okay, when a person passed away, I actually just got the Shiloh from my brother. He was on a call, and he's a Cohen, so he had to run out. Someone he arrived, and the person basically passed away, unfortunately, and he passed in this. So good job, Shimmy. You pour out all the water. Why do we do so? So one reason is to let everyone around you know that someone passed away. And the other reason is because it's more Kabbalistic, that the angel of death is around. Maybe he poisoned the water. And the Bnei Baruch says, again, halakha, we follow this halakha today. That being said, in the hospital, we don't need to do so because the primary reason is to inform others that someone died, which is less important in the hospital. They have other ways of mentioning it. Okay, good. Another custom to have is to open the windows, or at least open one window when the soul leaves. Okay, great. We then had a discussion, if you recall, this took place in my house, about organ donation. Not going to get into the details of that, but basically what it came down to is, from the perspective of science, organs, most of the organs, or many of the organs, have to be taken from a body that still has a working heart. Until rather recently, so long as someone's heart was working, they were alive. We now have, because of modern medical miracles, we can be pumping someone's heart using a ventilator, but their brain no longer is working. Their brainstem is dead, and therefore the only reason why their heart is working is because we are artificially pumping it. So the question really is what is considered the moment of death? Is it the lack of breathing, or is it the lack of a heartbeat? This was a much longer discussion, and we had lots of proofs back and forth, which I'm not going to get into now. You can go read in the notes or in the other literature I believe I sent out or could send out about desecrating Shabbos. When you find someone's buried, you start, you know, removing rocks, and you get to their heart, and the heart's not beating, or get to their nose and realize it's not breathing. It's about the heart. It's about the breathing. That was a long discussion. We said, again, it's b'machlokas. Both sides are very passionate, and we paskin at the end. We just mentioned Rav Schechter said, basically, that who knows? And this is a very weighty issue. Suffolk the Raisa L'chumra is basically what he said. But we'll leave it at that. Okay. After a person dies, we don't touch them for about 30 minutes. Then we carefully remove all their clothing. We cover them in a white cloth. We place them on the floor, directly on the floor. A rock should be put under their head. And we part of the reason we do this on the floor, it seemingly, is because the floor is colder. We don't want them to decompose. We also mentioned we don't cross their arms. That's a Christian idea. Okay. We even do this on Shabbos. We'll put like a piece of bread on the body so that we can move it, or we can put a tinok on it, a child, which I don't suggest. When you place the body on the floor, you ask it for forgiveness. You also, if the mouth is open, you close it. You will tie it down. You don't want air to enter. It causes anything to swell, any desecration of the body. And then we'll talk more about that, next year when we talk about different burial methods. Okay, next part is Hilchos Kriya. Hilchos Kriya is found here because, although, if you think in the chronology of Our modern day funerals, we generally do cremate at the funeral, which we'll discuss why in a minute, really happens the moment of death. And the experience that someone dies, even if it's someone who's not necessarily a relative, you're in the room with them, such as a doctor, you're supposed to perform cremation. Why do you perform cremation? So one reason I saw was we want to focus away from the material things. We rip it, say, yo, focus on death. Material things are it's just clothes. It's a beautiful Brooks Brothers shirt. It's clothes. It's nothing. Here's a body in front of you. It causes grief. It stirs up crying. By the way, for this reason, you can try to tear on any mace. It's not to just, you're allowed to elect to tear. It's not baltashless. But the halacha is we tear on the seven relatives, which are the same seven relatives that a Kohen comes tummy to, a wife, a father, a mother, brother, a sister who's not married, a son, or a daughter. And if someone has illegitimate children, they tear on them as well. So that is that. When do you perform the kriya? So again, we said really when a person soul departs, you make the bracha of dain emes, which is not a bracha on kriya. Some people think it is. I think Rav Schachter said like that's a mistake. It's not a bracha on kriya. It's a bracha on dain emes, when we're affirming the new truth. We're affirming God is true. Everything, and we're affirming a new reality. But the b'shas chimam, the moment of distress, is when you tear the kriya. We perform at a funeral. Why do we perform at a funeral? So we saw one answer. It could just be because we're going through all this hilchos kriya. It's complicated. The differences between if it's a father, if it's a child. The differences between if it's where to tear, how to tear, etc. So do it at a funeral when the rabbi, the chevra kedusha, are there to help teach you how to properly do it. Another reason why, again, just trying to figure out why the minhag is different than shulchan aruch, which we also said many times in hilchos avelos. Oftentimes the minhag is different than shulchan aruch, although kriya is not necessarily hilchos avelos. And one of the reasons we said this is because by hilchos avelos, the operative principle suffolk daraisa la. Kula, sorry, excuse me, by Hilchos Avelos, the operative principle, Suffolk Avelos Kula, by Kriya, we don't necessarily say that. Another reason is because it's best for someone else to at least begin the Kriya. We said, and we'll see that in a minute. The reason for that is because some say it's more humiliating and it brings a purpose in the meaning of the Kriya is to humiliate and to bring you down, to make you sad when someone else tears your clothes. And therefore, you know, there's more likely there are other people around at the funeral. We also mentioned others say, no, it's actually you should tear the kriya. It's more, you're sad, you're despondent. And by you tearing it, it really shows it, which is why we do is usually someone begins it and you finish it up. So that's reason number two. Reason number three is tearing for one's parents should be done in public, which is, again, funeral. And reason number four is you're supposed to be shas chimam, and oftentimes during when the eulogies are being done at the funeral, is really a shas chimam, a time of real distress. Okay. Fine. Moving on, when do we do it? Some do it at the beginning of the funeral. Some do it right after the funeral. If you perform kriya, by the way, on a relative thinking they passed away, it turns out they hadn't, so you have to do it again. Great. How do you perform kriya? So we said there's a difference between parents and everyone else. With parents, we're much stricter. The Gemara Moed Katan says, first of all, just points out, if you tear from the bottom or the side, you don't fulfill your obligation. It needs to be performed from the neck of the garment and downwards. It has to be performed on the front of the garment as well. Tearing on a ribbon does not you don't fulfill any obligation whatsoever. It has to be on the garment itself. With parents, you tear from the neckline down. Meaning you're supposed to tear, basically rend the garment in two. With other relatives, you could just tear in middle. You don't have to rend in two, although the Mishnah Tshuva says nowadays, we tear everything. We tear everything. Okay. The minhag is with parents to tear on the left side, meaning that's where the heart is. For everyone else, you perform on the right side. How much do you tear? So, and what do you tear? So we tear approximately, a tefach, which is 3 centimeters or so. For everyone else, for parents, you tear until your heart is exposed, which seemingly is where that is on your body. It's a lot longer. Also, another difference, by the way, is that for our relatives, you tear just one garment. For everyone else, you tear just for everyone, you tear the outermost garment. For your parents, you tear everything except for the Afi Karson, which we said, what's the Afi Karson? I don't even know how to pronounce that. Either it's an undershirt or it's an overcoat, which again, overcoat might mean something you don't normally wear inside. So then you can ask, what about a blazer, a suit jacket, a vest? So we'll get to all that. Although I believe Rav Willig Paskind that nowadays, Mikra Hadin, one does not tear a suit jacket and all that, just tear your shirt. But I think the minhag really is for a parent, we tear more than that. Okay. The So we did, that was that just that was pretty much I think I just covered everything right there. Covered there. Woman as well, and we'll do some practical examples in a second. Woman as well should tear, but we say tear the inner garment, turn it around, tear an outer garment, because we want to avoid any issues of tsinua, which is why we say when one goes to a funeral, just be prepared that be prepared to you're doing kriya, so you have to tear in a way that's not going to cause issues, bring safety pins, etc. They should bring safety pins, whereas men don't use safety pins. Fine. A suit jacket. So again, the suit jacket is going to come down to what exactly is it? Is it something you say? Some say it depends. If you always wear a suit jacket inside outside, you should tear it. With others say not to. And Yashiv said you should tear it. Others not to. Willow said be correct, you don't have to. And it comes, you know, that depends. What about a sweater? So again, a sweater could be the same way. Some wear sweaters inside. Some don't. Some say a sweater is just like a scarf. Lamaisa, it's again, or Willow say you don't have to. So I guess it's up to you. What about tzitzis? So some say tzitzis you have to, especially if you wear. Some say you don't have to because it's an inner garment. If you said that's the upper parson. Some say you don't have. Some say you should because you wear it outside. You live in Linden, so you can wear it outside. But others say no because you're wearing it for a mitzvah. You don't have to, and I think the mitzvah is not to. By the way, when it comes to parents, the obligation is to wear a torn garment, whereas when it comes to everyone else, the obligation is to tear. Which is why with the parents, if you put on a new garment during Shiva, you have to. Re-tear it. Okay. Again, we said, how do you tear? So I kind of briefly mentioned, let's say it again. So the Gemara says, first of all, anyone else, if you use a knife, parents, you should use your hands, although you can start off with a knife, just because especially our garments, it's hard to rip it from scratch, especially when you want to rip from like the lapel, where it's fortified in a way. You should tear for siblings, everyone else from the inside, for parents on the outside. So what does that mean? Either it's talking about where you do it from. You can place your hand inside the garment and rip it down from the inside, or you could do it in a secluded area. Whereas outside for parents is either you have to do it on the external side, ripping downwards, or it has to be done in public, which brings us back to what we said, why we do it perhaps at the funeral and not at the time of Misa. And we mentioned again switching clothing. You're allowed to. Switching clothing in terms of you're wearing your fanciest suit and someone dies. So we say that you're allowed to switch on because the obligation is to do kriya is not to have a garment that was koreya. So therefore you can switch your clothes if you need be. You don't have to do kriya on your pajamas. I'll give you the heter for that one. Okay, there are other instances when kriya is performed, such as standing next to someone who dies. What about a doctor? So we gave three reasons why a doctor have to not have to. Some say, or most seemingly said you should. Let's tear a little bit of it each time. Since the other said, look, doctors don't own their scrubs, which is not necessarily true. I think we asked some people. And Rav Shechna said, look, the whole idea of shas chimum is feeling that pain. A doctor doesn't feel that pain, that sense of anguish, because that's part of the profession. This might actually fit in with Rav Shechna. I believe I once heard, and don't quote me on this, or you can quote me on this, but I could be quoting me wrong, or I'm quoting Rav Shechna wrong, that he thought that anytime there's a shas chimum, there's a re-obligation to tear. So perhaps, you know, someone you haven't seen in a long time comes over, or the shoot soon as Havra, and you feel a sense of pain again, you don't have to re-tear. We then talked about tearing Yerushalayim in the Kotel, which I'm not going to get into now. You can go look up all that over there in the notes. There was a lot of that. We talked about the original shear. Then we talked about doing Kriya on Shabbos. If you do Kriya on Shabbos, you violate Shabbos. You fulfill your obligation of Kriya, which is kind of interesting. Whereas if you tear Kriya on an art garment, it's not yours, you don't fulfill your obligation. What about Chol HaMoed? So you're not supposed to do... on Chol HaMoed, the Shulchan Aruch said you should. The Ramah is only on a parent. And that seems to be the halacha. Okay, we'll stop over here. This is all part one, and we'll have some more coming out soon. I wish you all a wonderful day.